I'm Joey Block. We have a jam-packed show for you on this Holy Week edition of In the Middle. This is being put out on Good Friday. Maybe you're listening on Holy Saturday. Maybe if you had a lot going on this Holy Week going into the weekend, you're listening on Easter Monday or beyond. But regardless, we appreciate you being with us here. As always, we do have a jam show, but let's get right to it. There's a lot of news that happened on the national stage and even right next door to us. Starting out here in the Big Apple, a New York judge has issued a gag order barring former President Trump from commenting publicly about witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors in the upcoming Stormy Daniels trial. Judge Juan Merchant says the former president has a history of, quote, threatening, inflammatory, denigrating remarks about people involved with his legal cases. In the four-page decision, Merchant said, quote, given that the eve of the trial is upon us, it is without question that the imminency of the risk of harm is now paramount, close quote. The order bars Trump from either making or directing other people to make public statements on his behalf about potential witnesses and jurors in the trial. It also prohibits any statements meant to interfere with or harass the court staff, prosecution team, or their families. It does not prevent him from talking about Merchant himself, the judge in the case, and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is prosecuting this case. A violation could result in Trump being held in contempt of court, fined, or even jailed. On Truth Social, Trump called the gag order, quote, illegal, un-American, unconstitutional, close quote, saying that Merchant, quote, is wrongfully attempting to deprive me of my First Amendment right to speak about the weaponization of law enforcement, close quote. The trial is set to begin on April 15th. This comes after a judge in his civil fraud case reduced his bond to $175 million. You may remember that from last week. That was the big deal. Will he pay it or will he not? Well, the thing got reduced at the last moment. And now he has some time to get the cash together for that one to what's expected to be a less of a financial burden on him than the previous bond number that has been set. This is not the only election story that we have to deal with this week in regards to an effect on the 2024 race. Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has picked California lawyer and philanthropist Nicole Shanahan to be his running mate. Shanahan is the former wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin. She also has a large amount of wealth of her own. So she's got a large net worth there, you know, expected probably being around $1 billion. And she notably funded RFK's Super Bowl ad. You remember that one? When he was essentially doing the Kennedy, basically trying to emulate John F. Kennedy's famous 1960 ad, which, you know, a lot of that campaign ended up obviously electing him president. So it was kind of a redo on that. But essentially, she footed the bill for a large portion of those ads, and particularly that ad of getting Kennedy's name out there to one of the largest TV audiences of the year. Now, Kennedy does deny that her wealth was the reason why Shanahan was picked. Now, like Kennedy, interesting to note, Shanahan is also a former Democrat, honestly around the same time as RFK. She was, as far as we know, a Democrat up until this year, which is basically the same thing with Kennedy. Once he made the independent run, that's where he made the switch, and she's kind of around the same timeline there. Now, this isn't really a surprise, as she was floated as the possible pick and the most likely one to get picked. We've been hearing about this now for the last week or so, so it's not as surprising. We also heard about him possibly picking Aaron Rodgers and Jesse Ventura, who is a former governor of Minnesota and also a big wrestling guy. So you thought maybe he would go for maybe a high-profile name to get more attention to the campaign, but he ultimately went with someone who is lesser known. Now, she does have no experience running for political office, has never held political office before, but she's got big bucks. And although Kennedy denies it, that could play a part in whether she writes personal checks to this campaign. And that could help bolster him in places where, you know, he otherwise would have a problem. As it is, he's got to get ballot access in all 50 states. That's the plan in order to really be competitive in this thing. And for independent candidates, it's not the easiest thing in the world, because if you're a major party candidate, you have the party infrastructure. They just kind of do it for you and you get on and that's that. But with the independent part and any third party run for that matter, you have to go get all the signatures, takes all the money, do all the filing, all the paperwork. It's all on your own. You have to hold yourself accountable to it. So having someone like her around to do that kind of helps his case. It kind of gives him some legitimacy in that sense. And in the days afterwards, he ended up raising over $2 million. So clearly the choice was a good one financially in the short term. Kennedy has struggled with finance. In the last quarter, he only raised just a little over $3 million, which, you know, sounds like a lot of money, but for a presidential candidate who's doing a nationwide campaign, a major third-party campaign where you need a lot of cash, that's something that's a little concerning. You got to get more money in the bank in order to really be competitive. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, okay, it's March going into April, and we're already talking about a vice presidential pick? Why is that? I mean, you hear Trump kind of rumored about it. You know, Biden's got Vice President Harris, but why are we hearing about it from Kennedy first? Well, the reason why he's already committing to Shanahan, or really anyone, as the pick is because nearly half of the states that he's looking to get ballot access for require independent candidates to designate a vice presidential pick in order to gain access to that state's ballot. If you want to appear on that ballot, you have to have a running mate designated. So far, he's only on Utah's ballot, but he does say he has enough signatures in a number of states, including Arizona, Georgia, among others. So we will see how many states he gets on and how many he might not. We'll see if RFK Jr. is able to make that happen for him. Here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Newark Mayor and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ross Baraka is currently facing allegations of campaign finance allegations. The New Jersey Election Law Enforcement Commission claims Baraka, along with 8 city council members who ran on his slate, failed to file campaign finance reports for his 2022 re-election campaign. The agency alleges the Team Baraka joint campaign did not file 29-day pre-election, 11-day pre-election, or 20-day post-election reports, despite collecting over $713,000 coming from 590 contributions. and spending over $781,000. Now, the NJELEC says the campaign also failed to file a 48-hour report ahead of the election, the election day. In a statement, Baraka said, quote, "This is about filing necessary paperwork on time regarding our municipal races and absolutely needs to be done. We have a firm handling this, and I communicate to them that this was unacceptable and needs to be taken care of as soon as humanly possible. I believe in government transparency, and I am confident that this will be done and that every dollar will be accounted for and reported." Close quote. Now, it's important to note here that we spoke to Mayor Baraka as part of a previously scheduled interview that took place before this report came out. Of course, we're going to see how this all plays out and whether the state election agency figures this all out and the Baraka team. But again, that is regarding his most recent Newark mayoral reelection bid, not the gubernatorial race. The gubernatorial race is a totally separate thing, but we just wanted to get that out there for you. But specifically, what we spoke to the mayor of Newark is what's going on with his gubernatorial campaign. Here's the discussion in full. I want to start off by talking about your effort to get a promotion here in state politics.
Yeah.
You're currently running for governor. What made you decide to get in this race?
Well, I think now is the opportune time to do it. I think there are things happening in the country and in the state that makes it a reasonable opportunity for us to get involved in this. I think it's time to build a broad-based coalition around the state of New Jersey across the things that usually separated us, zip code, race, sexual preference, gender, all of those things, to build a broad-based coalition to deal with economic prosperity and the equity there, to make sure that we do something about the rising cost of living in this state, be able to give people access to things they have not had access to. And I think the things that are the primary things that we rave about in New Jersey are also our weaknesses. Like, we have some of the best educational institutions in this country, but all of us are not in those institutions. The gap between those who benefit from those institutions and those who don't are wide, right? We have some of the best healthcare institutions and facilities, but the gap between those who have access to that healthcare and those who don't are also wide. You know, the segregation in the state is very deep. We have a huge wealth gap in this state, and I think it's time for us to come up with new imaginative ways to deal with not just inequity, but deal with the cost of living and economic prosperity for all people in New Jersey. And I think it takes people who are closer to the problems to come up with the solutions to these things. And we've been really electing the same people over and over and over again with different names and different genders, but the same person, you know. And we've rarely, or if at all, taken a chance on something really imaginative, something different. And I think I bring that to the table. A pilot who has been dealing with turbulence all of my life and every day in the city of Newark, solving problems that people think are Newark-based problems, but are really are statewide issues that I think we can bring to bear and help the state realize its potential.
The field could potentially be quite wide on your side of the aisle, with people like Steve Fulop and Steve Sweeney already in the race and names being floated like Mikey Sherrill and Josh Gottheimer. How do you plan to compete against the other candidates?
Well, first, we welcome all of those people into the race. Democracy is important. I think we all have some similar things to say, as we all are Democrats, prayerfully. But I think that we'll get a chance to differentiate between the candidates, as we go on this campaign trail. We are running a seriously grassroots campaign and trying to go to people with the issues and have them come to us. Clearly, I think we have a pathway. The same way the governor of this state, Murphy, won the last election, is the same way we intend to win. Everywhere where he lost, we will probably lose at. And everywhere he won, we think we will win and win even better. We have a base that I think other candidates don't have. We have a clear base in this state. And we're just going to build on that base and add more folks to it and build a broad-based coalition around the state. And I think the state is ready for something new and something more imaginative than what we have.
Now, Guttheimer and Sherrill in particular are known to be monster fundraisers. With all these potential candidates in the race, it splits up the amount of money to go around. How can you ensure that you're going to get your piece of the pie?
Well, first, I think we're going to do matching funds, and I think everybody should do public campaign financing. But I think we, as I said, we have a base, and we have a very specific group of people that we can raise money from. First, grassroots folks all up and down the state of New Jersey who can give from $5 to $25 to $30 if they have it. We're going to be going after those dollars. But also, you know, just the background that I have, the arts and education and entertainment community, the ability to reach out to some of the folks that have done incredible work with us in the city of Newark, and people who believe in what we're pushing. I think we wouldn't have a problem raising the necessary money to be competitive in this campaign, and we look forward to it.
Now, I know you say that you have a grassroots campaign, but the name of the game is endorsements in politics, particularly in New Jersey politics. A big part of winning the primary is getting those endorsements, including those in your home county of Essex, which is where Congresswoman Sherrill lives. Prominent politicians in Essex County have expressed interest in backing her, including former governor and now retired state senator Richard Cody. He openly threw his support behind her on this very show, in fact, last year, despite her not being a declared candidate. Why should leaders in Essex County back you over other potential candidates?
Well, we've actually done the work, and they know the work we've done. Everybody in Essex County knows clear what we've done in Newark. They can see it. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, from making sure we have a balanced budget and create an economy that's fair and equitable for all, to create billions of dollars worth of development in the city, get the states back, our schools back from the state, to replace all these lead service lines, to drop crime down to a 60-year low since John F. Kennedy was a president. We've actually done this work, right? We're not speaking about things we will do. We're speaking about things that we've already done. I actually run a major corporation right now, which is the city of Newark. I'm an executive, and we make decisions in turbulence every single day. And I think county leaders know this, and they're clear on it, and they're clear that we have a base that will support that, no matter what these folks say. We support them. We encourage them to get in the race. And I would love the support from any of the county leaders in this county and all over the state of New Jersey. You know, but we're going after regular mom and pop voters. And their children. We want to go to them and speak to them and get them to the polls and get them to vote for us. We want to do that and empower them to be able to make decisions about what's going to happen in their lives.
Now, I know you say it's all about going after the mom and pop voters, not so much about what the party establishment may think. But a guy like Richard Cody, you know him well because he's been in Essex County.
Very well.
And in fact, Essex County is a large part of it is Newark, so you do have that advantage. But if a guy like that is backing someone like Sherrill, doesn't that make your path harder in your home county?
Well, you know, Cody, and you know, was swore me in when I first won as the mayor in the city of Newark. So he knows what we've done in this state, in through the city of Newark. So I think our path is going to be difficult anyway, but anything worth having is difficult. I don't think this is an easy, sure thing for us to do, but I think that the opportunity is there and the probability is high. And we're going to outwork anybody in this campaign. I mean, we're going to outwork them. We're going to put the issues to the forefront and let, you know, our record and our vision speak for itself. And I think, like, I've always run my life, you know, in these campaigns against huge folks who endorsed opponents against me, even when I ran for mayor. I mean, we had the whole county machine against us, but we came out and we prevailed. So I think we have a history of doing that, and we're not afraid of that. You know, we're going to get out here and win as many people over as we can. And that's just the name of the game. And I think as soon as I get in front of people, it becomes more difficult for them to deny what we represent and what we intend on doing.
Let's move ahead here to the general election. Let's say you get the nomination. You will be going up against history. Neither political party the major political parties, Democrat or Republican, has won a third consecutive term to the governor's mansion here in New Jersey since 1961. What is your path to defy that history?
That's why we're reimagining this state. And I think what's happening in the country and what's being brought to bear around the country, the divisiveness, the kind of right-wing politics that's dominating not just the national scene, but the international scene, people are looking for relief. They're looking for something new, different, people to speak what they say and say what they speak, you know, to do the things that they say they're going to do and stand behind it, that are not wishy-washy. And I think we represent that. And we represent that for both groups, as a matter of fact. I mean, we might disagree on policy and specific issues around how we think we solve these problems. But there's no doubt in folks' mind that what we say we're going to do and what we do we're going to say. And that's important for us. And, you know, I think that with the momentum that we're going to build, the movement that we're going to create, we're just going to excite people to come to the polls. And I look forward to that.
On NJ Spotlight News a couple of weeks ago, Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, who is also a primary opponent of yours, he's in this race too, was asked why he thinks a mayor from a municipality, his municipality, Jersey City or Newark, hasn't been elected governor. You're the mayor of the largest city in the state with hundreds of thousands of constituents. Why hasn't there been a governor who has previously served as a big city mayor from a place like yours?
Well, actually, we actually had a mayor from Newark many, many, many years ago. He was actually the first mayor to abolish slavery in the state of New Jersey, but that was a long time ago. But I think that New Jersey has organized itself in such a way where we believe the big city mayors should support mayors as opposed to support governors as opposed to run for governor. We actually are closest to the problems. And most of the problems that the state have, we battle every single day in these cities. And we have to be as creative and ingenious as we possibly can to solve some of these intractable issues that stay with us for decades. So I think it's high time that, you know, we get a mayor to be a governor of this state. And ultimately, as I said, most of the things that we're talking about are going to be very similar, whether you're talking about Mikey Shirelles or Gottenheimer or myself or Fulop. We're going to be talking about some of the same issues because we're all Democrats and we believe fundamentally have some of the same shared values as Democrats had. How those things accomplished and who has a record for doing those things and a wide variety or opportunity to pull people into a bigger tent is what's important, and who's going to build the momentum and get people excited about this campaign, about being a Democrat in New Jersey, about fighting for the values that we fight for in New Jersey. Who's going to excite the base in this state to get us to win, right? And reporters always ask me, what am I going to do to get the white vote? And I always say, well, that's the question for all Democrats, because Democrats in New Jersey have not gotten the majority of the white vote in a long time. So that's not an issue for Black people. That's an issue for Democrats. And it has to do with our inability to excite our base and to lay out a strategy and a plan that brings everybody into the fold. That does not separate folks and that invites everybody, which is democratic principles, to get them to be a part of a growing economy in the state. And I think we do that very clearly and openly.
It's important to note the term for your current job is up in 2026. If you don't win the nomination or general election next year, you do have the option to run for mayor once again. You haven't said what your plans are yet. Will you run for mayor again if this doesn't work out for you?
Well, honestly, I'm not sure, right? You know, I'm the type of person that I play the game that I'm in. So at this stage, I plan on winning. So I'm going to work as hard to win this campaign as much as we possibly can, right? And when we come to that road, we'll figure it out. But right now, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to become the governor of the state of New Jersey.
Now, I know you say you're focused on this, but when could you realistically expect to make that decision? Would it be a late 2025 decision? Would it be earlier, depending on where you're on the campaign?
It would depend on how the campaign unfolds. That's what it depends on, how the campaign unfolds, what my family feels about it. You know, this is not decisions that I make on my own. This is what my family feels about it, what the people around me feel about it, and, you know, what our opportunity is. to support and help Newark get better? Like, does that mean us not being in local politics? Does it mean us being in local politics? So that's a bigger decision, and I think it unfolds based on where we are in this campaign.
Now, I want to turn to a different subject here. In light of Congressman Andy Kim's lawsuit calling for the end of the county organizational line, there has been more questions being raised about the political structure here in New Jersey. You've addressed some of them. Even without the line, party leaders will still be able to issue endorsements awarding their preferred candidates with the county slogan, along with resources to bolster campaigns. Tom Moran, who wrote an op-ed for the Star-Ledger, he said in the op-ed, essentially makes that point, saying Democrats need to get away from machine politics in New Jersey, and wrote specifically, quote, "The courts can kill the line, but they can't force the party to reform its internal rules. The same goes for the legislature. This effort has to be a cultural fight, a battle for the soul of the party," close quote. You have been a critic of the county organizational line. Does there need to be...
Yeah, but it's not just Democrats either. Yeah, it's both parties, by the way, but go ahead.
Does there need to be further reform in the Democratic Party's nomination process beyond just the line?
Yeah, I would say New Jersey in general. I don't think this is germane to the Democrats, but I would say that, you know, he's right. There is a culture that has taken place because of the frequency of these things happening, even in district leaders, pulling away district leader lines and giving it to other people, you know, appointing people to become legislators who've never done anything, who've not been involved in politics, who've not engaged in even the community activism in any way. You know, they just make or break people. And I think that's problematic because it kind of undermines democracy, the idea of democracy. And I would get that the Democrats should be opposed to it more because we should be figuring out how to make this process more democratic. How do we figure out same-day registration? How do we figure out automatic registration? All of these kinds of things that we should be trying to do to make it easier for people to vote and easier for them to access politics, not putting the power and authority in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And he's right. There's some things that need to happen up and down the state internally. First of all, there should be one way this is done around the state of New Jersey, period, right? And not 21 different ways based on 21 different individuals who are wielding power. Those things need to change. And I think when that change, it begins the a domino effect, an avalanche, if you will, of changes that will come because the party line is no more.
Now, the guy leading the lawsuit is Congressman Andy Kim. He's currently running for Senate. Last weekend, New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy suspended her campaign, leaving the congressman as the frontrunner in this race. Congressman Kim attended your most recent State of the City address. Do you plan on voting for him in June?
Who I vote for is you know, my own business, but we're working closely with Congressman right now, right? So we're working closely with him right now. So, you know, I don't have no problem with him. I think that he's a great candidate. And I think we are closely aligned in a lot of the issues. So, you know, right now we are supporting his efforts. So I would say that. And, you know, I think that he led this push against this reform in the state that I think is long overdue. And I credit him for doing that.
I know you say you want to keep your vote private as it's your personal visit, but just going off that point, do you not plan on any type of public endorsement in this primary? You're essentially going to stay out of it till June?
I don't know. I don't even know if it's necessary, but we'll see. I think we're going to convene and talk to my folks. We'll see if they even care that we do that or not. I don't even know if the Kim campaign cares if we even do that. So we'll figure that out.
Now, I know we're running low on time here, but I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said the segregation in this state is deep. And you said we need to close the gap, both from wealth-wise. There's been an argument, and you've probably heard it a lot amongst certain people, that, you know, African-Americans have historically not had the same economic advantages as, let's say, white people do and all that. I'm sure, obviously, from why reporters keep asking you about winning the white vote and all that, there have been people who have called for reparations to happen. And there's even been some movement on that in New Jersey. Are you a supporter of that? Is that something that New Jersey would do? And would you sign that into law as governor?
Well, there is no law to sign. Right now, people are at least are asking to have a discussion. And I think that we in this liberal state have been allergic to even having a discussion. I think that that is the beginning. And that's what people are at least fighting for initially, to allow us to have a discussion about reparations and the history and of disenfranchisement in the state of New Jersey. I think that that has to happen. I mean, people seem to be allergic to that, as if people are saying that they're responsible for slavery. No, the inadvertent kind of effects and some deliberate effects of institutional racism that exists as a result of that still impacts families in this state. And we need to figure that out, not just as a matter of social historical preference, but as a matter of economic prosperity for the state and for individual families. And we should have this discussion. And to be afraid to have that discussion is undemocratic in my mind.
Do you think reparations are absolutely necessary? I know you say we need to have the discussion, but are they a necessary part and something you could see yourself being a key initiative in your administration?
Sure. I think they are necessary, 100%. Just as it was necessary for the Marshall Plan to exist after, you know, the World War, as it was necessary for other individuals in the state, or groups in the state, in this country, excuse me, who were harmed, who received reparations because of the harm that was done to them. So it is absolutely necessary. How that looks, how that plays out, what that resembles is something that the smart people in the state are going to have to come together, discuss, and figure out. But that is extremely important to close the wealth gap that people are saying are going to take over 200 years to do, which will harm more generations of folk who are trying to make the American dream real for them in the state of New Jersey.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there and see where your campaign goes. New Jersey Democratic gubernatorial candidate and Newark Mayor Ross Baraka, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
State lawmakers are currently weighing revisions to the Open Public Records Act here in New Jersey. Known as OPRA, the law allows the public to request information, particularly journalists, about public documents, and they can request to have them given to them by certain government entities. And a lot of it pertains to transparency within the government. Whether you want a certain document, how a certain law was decided, you can make that request using this act. Well, journalists and activists alike in the political world say that the new bill would weaken this law that's in place. Activists say it would make government significantly less transparent. Journalists also claim the bill would make it harder for them to do their job. The bill, in its current form, would also limit access to information like personal cell phone numbers and email addresses for commercial data companies. So basically for companies that would make a profit off of having this type of information. That's basically the deal there. Well, join me now to discuss this is New Jersey 16th Legislative District Democratic State Senator Andrew Zwicker. He is the only Democrat who voted against the bill when it was in committee on the state Senate side of things, and the rest were all Republicans there. There was a Democrat who voted against this when a similar version in the state assembly was taken up in a committee. But besides from that, Zwicker is the only one. So he joins us now. State Senator Zwicker, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Joey, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Happy to be on today.
The State Senate Budget and Appropriations Committee initially sent this bill to the full legislature to consider. You sit on this committee. You voted against the most recent OPRA reform legislation in committee. You were the only Democrat on that Senate committee to oppose the bill. Why'd you vote it down?
So let's, before I answer that question, let's just take a step back for a minute just to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about, right? Open Public Records Act. These are government records, could be municipal, county, state, in a department somewhere within the state. But these are public records that have been paid for by the taxpayers. And this is just a, you know, how can anybody request access to these? What are they requesting? It could be everything from a list of everyone who got a dog license to correspondence between two agencies talking about, I don't know, the development of a property, whatever it might be. But the key thing here is that these are public records paid for by the public, owned by the public. And this is a process for the public to get access to the records. The law in question was written about more than 20 years ago and has never been updated. And of course, in 20 years, enormous things have changed, and, you know, especially the fact that we live our lives online, that the digital world has, you know, increased in ways that we would never even imagine. And so OPRA is a set of rules that absolutely needs to be reformed. That part nobody disputes, because what's happening, I mentioned dog licenses, you know, you get a dog, you apply for a dog license, and then next thing you know, you're getting phone calls or emails or mail to your home from dog fence companies. Well, how would they even know? Well, they OPRA'd, that's how you say it, they OPRA'd the municipality, got a list and started soliciting everybody. That's not what the law was designed to do. The law was designed to provide transparency for people to understand how government is making decisions. So, okay, need to get updated. What happened? So a bill was introduced that had a bunch of reforms in it, a bunch of changes, some of which were to try to, in particular, reduce this volume of requests that are just for commercial purposes, because there's someone on the other end of that request who has to try to find the records. And so, you know, you ask for every email you've ever written your department for a year. Well, that's a tough request to, you know, is it a justified request? And then it's a tough request to satisfy. So there was a bunch of reforms in there that were, I think, part of what we need to look at for updating OPRA. There's a whole bunch of other ones where, and you just alluded to it in your question, where good government folks, the state comptroller, Kevin Walsh, who's someone who's supposed to keep an eye on government overall, the head of the Office of the Public Defender, and a whole bunch of other advocates came out and said, the bill is currently written would not update and reform OPRA, and it would reduce transparency. That to me is a big concern. I believe strongly that we need an open and transparent government. And so I didn't think this was a bill that was ready for moving on to the floor for full consideration by the Senate. And so I voted, as you indicated, against the bill. I think it needs a lot more work.
You said it needs a lot more work. A State Assembly Speaker, Craig Coughlin, apparently agrees with you on that point, because he took the bill off the chamber's agenda before it could be considered, saying more fixes need to be made. Where is the legislature currently in terms of making these reforms outlined by the Assembly Speaker as well as yourself?
So there's been a lot of discussions that have been going on. I have not been a part of those discussions, so I can't give you the details, but there have been a lot of discussions. So those who came to testify in front of the Senate Budget Committee hearing, many of them came not just to say they don't think this bill is ready to move forward, but they came with very specific recommendations for how they believe this bill needs to be amended. Those have been passed on to a variety of different folks, and we shall see what happens. You know, I withhold my own judgment. Like I said, I believe we need to reform OPRA, but we have to do it properly. So I withhold my own judgments on whether or not the next version of the bill is good or bad until I see what the amendments are.
Now, I know you want to wait and see what the amendments are, but based on what you've laid out, what would bring you to a yes for these reforms? What is that specific thing?
Yeah. So look, we want to try to reduce commercialization. We want to try to reduce the burden on the people who own the records. I would like to see for instance, money going towards digitization processes. I'd like to see amendments to the law that say, if you put something online, then you can just point someone to where it is online and that would satisfy their request. I would like to see disputes resolved quickly. These sort of things, the devil is always in the details, but these sort of things are critically important. And so that's just a small little bit of it. And then the things that some people say would reduce transparency, having to know specifics about an email between person A and person B and a subject matter. People have, I think, rightfully said, well, how would you possibly know if you're asking for a record who it was between and what the subject was if you didn't already have it? And so there's a whole bunch of things that I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens. And that's just a few examples.
You mentioned the email portion. I know you're critical on that aspect of why would someone ask for a specific subject line and email correspondence between two people if they didn't already have it. But if we go back to like 2020 when the pandemic was occurring and there was all this information and people were confused and regulations going back and forth, some people might say that they would want correspondence between those in state government about these things that would happen, especially a novel virus like COVID-19, where we never dealt with something like that before and people wanted to know the logic behind those conversations. Doesn't it make sense to ask for correspondence between, people who would be involved in those decisions to kind of see what was going behind the scenes and where, how they came to the decisions that they did?
Of course. And so let me be more precise. Of course, I didn't mean to imply that those shouldn't be part of what people want to know. The draft bill that was in front of us said, if you didn't know that it was between person A and person B on subject C, then you couldn't make the request. What you should be able to say is, I would like to know what, give me the correspondence between the Department of Health and make something up, the Attorney General about COVID. You don't need to know that it was this specific person. How would you know even the name of the person? So I agree with you, right? The proposal was so specific that it would have allowed the record keeper to deny legitimate requests like you're talking about. To me, that wasn't acceptable.
I know you're not involved directly with the negotiations here, but you kind of have your ear in Trenton of what's going on. How quickly could we see a revised bill brought to the floor of either the state assembly or the state senate? It could be soon, could be later. What's the timeline on that?
I know that there are people working hard to try to have a new version of the bill ready in the next couple of weeks. Both the assembly and the senate have their next voting session on April 15th on tax day. And there will be committee hearings in the days or the week before that. After that, we go into what's called the budget break, a lot of negotiations around the state budget. There won't be voting sessions until June. So the answer is either in the next couple of weeks or it'll be, 3 months or so before we see anything.
Right. So if it doesn't happen the next couple of weeks, you're saying that potentially we might not even bring this bill back up again until we have a new state budget in place?
Possibly, or right before we do, to be determined. But yeah, it's either the next few weeks or not for quite some time.
I want to go to a different subject here and get your expertise on voting in New Jersey. That is something that's come under scrutiny in how the whole process works, particularly how on the candidate side of things and how candidates are elected in the state. And one prominent candidate, Congressman Andy Kim, who's running for Senate now, has waged a battle on the county organizational line in federal court. He's trying to abolish it. You have been a critic of the county line, but you have also run on the line a number of times yourself, including your most recent bid for re-election. Given that you've benefited from the line, why are you against it now?
So the reality is it's a little bit nuanced, but I have not been a critic of, that's what you mean by the county line too, right? I have not been a critic of parties and county parties. I've not been a critic of Democratic Party or Republican Party or the ability of a organization to choose their candidates. What I've been concerned about is what is often referred to as ballot Siberia, where you take a candidate who does not have the endorsement of the county organization, whether that is Democrat or Republican, and you put them far, far, far away from the first two columns, which are traditionally where Democrat, one line would be Democrat, one line would be Republican. That then means that, you know, voters, unless they are specifically looking for a particular candidate, may not even notice that another person running for this office is not around. So, I think there are lots of ways that we can have a fair ballot while continuing to have strong parties, because that is, strong political parties is the foundation of our democracy.
You say you want strong parties even without a county organizational line. You say you're opposed to what's called ballot Siberia, basically the part of the county organizational line which gives preferential ballot positioning to preferred candidates by county party officials. Now, in light of the county organizational lawsuit, there's been questions being raised about the political structure here in New Jersey. Even without the line, party leaders will still be able to issue endorsements awarding their preferred candidates with the county slogan, along with resources to bolster campaigns. Tom Moran wrote in an op-ed for the Star Ledger where he essentially makes this point, saying Democrats need to get away from machine politics in New Jersey, and wrote, quote, "The courts can kill the line, but they can't force the party to reform its internal rules. The same goes for the legislature. This effort has to be a cultural fight, a battle for the soul of the party." Now, I know you say you like strong parties, which by what I'm getting from what you're saying is that you think county parties should be able to weigh in on these primaries. But based on the criticisms that we've been hearing from a lot of grassroots activists, really on both sides, does there need to be some kind of change, particularly in the Democratic Party, where some people may not like the way the system is now?
A couple things, right? The system is the same in both parties. It's just that the Democratic Party is the majority party. And so, and has been for multiple decades at this point in New Jersey, where there are, on the order of a million more Democrat registered Democrats than there are Republicans. So do I think that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that there should be an ability to endorse and to provide a slogan, to provide resources? Yeah, I do. One could argue there should be more than, other countries have more than one political party. There have been movements to try to create in the Green Party, the Libertarian Party here in the United States. But we organize ourselves in our democracy under political parties with shared values. And we've been doing that since the birth of the country. So it has a system that has worked and will continue to work. And so while, there is both the court case you're referring to and lots of discussion about reforming the design of the ballot, I don't think we are talking about somehow moving to a time where there are no political parties. That's just not the history of our country.
So you say that without these party chairs essentially weighing in the county committees and all that, that there would be no party, essentially, if people just randomly plopped on the ballot, that the two major parties wouldn't be able to survive in the state or really anywhere the way things are now?
Right. I mean, you know, regardless of any criticism that's out there, it depends on the size of the county, but there are sometimes hundreds upon hundreds of committee members all weighing in on the, you know, who they would like to see. Right. And then there's a chair of that committee. Right. Now, there have been a lot of criticism and a lot of valid criticism of what's gone on in the United States Senate race. But the basis of that is people who are actively involved in their party, believe in the strength of their party, coming together to choose candidates that they think will best represent the party in an upcoming election. To me, that is the foundation of how we are doing, how our democracy works. That's true in New Jersey, but that's true in the other 49 states as well.
You brought up the Senate race. Last weekend, New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy suspended her campaign, leaving Congressman Andy Kim the front runner in this race. Do you plan on voting for Kim in June?
You know, I will wait. How would I say this? There are several candidates out there right now. Andy, I've known for a long time. I know the other candidates as well. Andy brings an enormous amount of experience. He's very thoughtful about how he approaches legislation, and he's a real representative of his constituency in the district he currently represents. I think he would make a outstanding United States Senator, but you know, we'll get there until the June primary before deciding who I'm actually going to vote for.
So you're not going to weigh in before the June primary, correct? You're going to let the voters decide instead?
That's called democracy.
Speaking of democracy, Governor Murphy, a couple months ago, signed your very first bill in the state legislature, kind of sat there for a number of years, but then the governor finally, you kind of brought it back to life, got the whole legislature to pass it, and Governor Murphy signed it, and the bill allows 17-year-olds to vote in New Jersey's primaries if they turn 18 by the general election. Talk to me about the significance of allowing this group to cast their ballots in the primary.
I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, this is the very first bill I ever wrote back in 2016. And it was took 8 years to get it to the governor's desk. And, you know, that's how often it works in Trenton. Some bills move quickly, like the Oprah bill you talked about. Some bills are a slow, slow burn. In this case, I have strongly believed, as the parent of three young adults, that we need to make sure that young people are engaged in our political process, because in the end, we are putting forth public policies that have impact not just today or tomorrow, but for, you know, generations. And so making sure that young people are engaged is so critically important. It's why I wrote that as my very first bill. So the bill allows 17-year-olds to vote in primaries as long as they're 18 by the time the general election in November comes around. And it's really simple, because study after study has shown once a voter, always a voter. So if we can get young people to vote when they're 17 and get excited about having their voice heard, whether it's on climate change, whether it is on clean air, clean water, whether it is on any topic that is important to a young person, then I want them to vote, and then I hope they will continue to vote year after year after year. So I was thrilled that we got it through both houses of the legislature, and Governor Murphy signed the bill shortly after that.
You say engaging younger voters is important. Governor Murphy took it a step further in the State of the State address a couple months ago. He called for 16 and 17-year-olds across New Jersey to be allowed to vote in school board elections. Is that something you support doing?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting proposal because of the fact that You know, who better to have some say about what's happening in schools than the students themselves? I love that they're being engaged. You know, we'll see how that plays out. But I support anything that gets young people more involved in our political process.
Do you see yourself getting personally involved in that effort in a legislative way, or are you going to just let it play out, kind of see where it goes?
My next thing, I'll let that play out. My next thing is something that I've also been working on for years, which is a system called ranked choice voting. And, you know, we can go into the details of what that means or not, but it's another way to try to, in the end, you can say, I like two candidates. You can rank them. I like this one first, this one second. And so you can get your voice heard over multiple candidates. Other states have done this, and it's been really successful. I'd love to see New Jersey start to do this as well. And I've been working on this for years.
You brought up ranked choice voting. I definitely want to get to that because it is a proposal that has captured the interest of many in the state. It has received some, and it's been somewhat well received in certain parts of the state. They've tried to use it, but the critics say this could be difficult to implement statewide due to the fact that we are a home rule state. Does this obstacle make it nearly impossible to make ranked choice voting a reality in New Jersey?
I don't think so at all. Look, this has nothing to do, in my opinion, with home rule. This has to do with making sure people's voices are heard. And so, you know, in this case, you would go into the voting booth just like you normally would, but instead of voting for one person in a particular primary, you'd vote for them all. You would just rank them. And whoever got the most votes, it's another one, it's called instant runoff, but whoever got the most votes would then, just like normally, would move on to the general election. I see no reason why we can't do this in New Jersey as well.
And do you see this happening like as a statewide race for, let's say, Senate or governor, or is it something you see being more implemented at the local level, like a school board election, like a mayoral election?
Right. So I actually have put a bunch of different proposals out there. One would be for every election from president on down. The other one would be just for local elections. And to your point about home rule, that one, if it's only going to be for local elections, would only be if the town passed a resolution to say they want to do it. So it wouldn't impose it. The individual towns would have that choice to decide if they want to do that at their local election. Seems like the best of both worlds to me.
Definitely, for sure. We'll have to see how that all plays out and what voting looks like in New Jersey going forward. New Jersey 16th Legislative District Democratic State Senator Andrew Zwicker, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Joey.
Well, that about does it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X at @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, in case you just found the show for the very first time, like, oh my God, I love the show. It's so great, but where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You got to go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You put that in, all the podcasts are going to show up for the Fox Sports New Jersey page. Then you're going to scroll down until you find In the Middle with Joey Block. You're going to click on that, and all the episodes will be there. We'll have the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Now, before we go, from my family to yours, I'd like to wish you a happy Easter and hope you are having a joyous Holy Week. And for those who are non-religious, hope you have some good time with the Easter Bunny and that you're getting some good candy. Thank you so much for listening. As always, it has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.